After Purim, I want to get back, at least for a week or two, back to the Mishkan, and then we'll probably jump into Pesach after that. You know, as holidays come around, we like jumping around a little bit. But for at least this week and next week, I think we'll discuss more parts of the Mishkan than we were doing a few weeks ago. We are up now to the next vessel of the Mishkan, which is the Shulchan, the table. I'll show the picture and we'll discuss the details. I mean, the table is actually hard to see picture. It's not a great picture at all, because really behind this whole structure is a little table. And the actual Shulchan is this table which is behind this whole structure standing here, which is difficult to see from the picture. The structure holds up, there's 12 showbreads, Lechem Apanim. And the structure was made to hold up the 12 showbreads.
It's like a bakery tray.
Yeah, kind of like a bakery tray. Made out of gold. And bakery tray. So we'll see, we'll talk about the details in a minute. So the picture is not such a clear picture from this book, but there is a golden table in there. With legs, like a normal table, back there. And we'll discuss some details in a minute. So the next vessel is the Shulchan. The Shulchan was when one walked into the actual Mishkan, or the Beis HaMikdash. So in the outer room, which was the holy room, the Kodesh, this is in the northern side of the Kodesh. So the way it was structured, the Holy of Holies was in the west. So when you walked in, you would see on your right, you would see the Shulchan. That's what you would see. So that's the Shulchan. The Shulchan was meant to hold the showbreads, which we'll discuss in a minute. Let's just go through some details of the Shulchan, then we'll discuss, as we always do, the lessons and the message of the Shulchan. The Shulchan's dimensions were 2 amos by 1 amma by 1.5 amos, which in other terms would be approximately 4 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet, assuming an amma is about 2 feet or so. So 4 feet by 2 feet by 3 feet. The 1.5 was the height. It was about 3 feet high. That was the Shulchan. The actual table was wooden. It was a wooden plank made out of atzei shittim, this type of cedar wood, and it was coated in gold. It had something on it called the misgeres, which was a rim, which again it's hard to see on this picture, but there's actually a rim around the table. It's a dispute in the Gemara if the rim was actually an edge of the table itself, kind of like, a tray holding gimlets on the table, or if the rim was around the legs. That's the view where this rim was. But there was a rim called a misgeres around the table. Mems, in Hebrew? Mems esamnech gimel resh taf. The modern Hebrew frame is a misgeres. It's a frame in modern Hebrew.
I was just wondering if it was 2 samos, shin or sin.
Right, okay. Okay, so that's the misgeres, the rim. So dispute exactly where it was, but there was certainly a rim going around, either around the table or around the legs. So some sort of frame or rim going around it. Coming off of the misgeres was a crown, a zer. And again, the picture is hard to see. You could see a little crown coming up over here. You can pass this around for we discussed how the Aron had a zer, had a crown. Now we see the Shulchan has a crown, and we'll talk about also the incense also had a crown. There are three crowns. Three different vessels had crowns on them. So this one also had a crown. That's the zer. The crowns always represent a type of nobility. We discussed, I was mentioning again, that the three crowns mentioned in the... There's three crowns that a Jew can achieve. There's the Keser Kahuna, the crown of being a Kohen. There's the Keser Malchus, the crown of being a king. And the Keser Torah, the crown of being a Torah scholar. So the king is reserved for the house of King David. The crown of Kahuna is reserved for the Kohanim. Those come from the tribe of Levi, from Aaron Kohen. But the crown of Torah, every Jew can achieve. So the Aron had a crown that represents the crown of Torah. The incense altar has a crown representing the crown of priesthood, of Kahuna. And this has a crown representing the crown of kingship. We'll discuss why that is. This crown represents the crown of being a Jewish king. That's what the crown on the Shulchan, on the table, represents. There are rings on the four corners, as you can see in the picture as well. And those rings were to hold the poles, because they would transport this in the desert. So they put poles through it, and they would transport it through the desert with these poles. So you had rings on all four corners for the poles. The poles were wooden poles covered in gold. They're called badim, similar poles that we saw, that's what we discussed in the Aron itself. There are poles as well. In the Aron, we did discuss how the poles have to remain in the Aron at all times. These poles could be removed. So the halacha is, it's a mitzvah, or it's a prohibition. One may not remove the poles from the Aron, but one is allowed to remove the poles from the Shulchan once the Shulchan is set in its place. So that is a difference that we see. Around it, as we pointed out before,
why?
Why what?
Why can one be removed?
Well, the message in the Aron is that we discussed a few weeks ago was that Torah is something which is never stuck in one place. You know, the Torah goes with you at all times. So to say I'm going to put down the Aron, take out his poles, and say you're going to stay here, that's a wrong message for a Jew. It's that the Aron comes wherever I go. Torah is with me. So the Aron has a special mitzvah to keep the poles in at all times. The Jewish king is not something you stuff with you every place you go. The Jewish king is its own entity. I guess that would be in the symbolism of it. That's the difference. The around it, so as I showed you before, there is a structure which is positioned around the table, which holds up 12 showbreads. So there's a mitzvah called Lechem Apanim. Lechem Apanim, they would bake 12, really they're matzahs. They were not chametz, they're matzahs. 12 matzahs. I mean, matzahs, as we see, is a crunchy cracker. But matzah could technically be thicker and fluffier if we weren't so scared of chametz. So they made actually breads, but they were not chametz. They did not rise for 18 minutes. They were matzah, 12 of them. And they would bake those breads on Friday. They would, every single Shabbos, they would switch the breads for new breads. So they would come in, they would take off the old breads and put on the new breads every single Shabbos, and the Kohanim would eat the new bread, the old breads. The Kohanim would get to eat those breads. It was a miracle that these breads would remain fresh and warm the entire week long. If you take a piece of bread, put it on your kitchen table, come back in a week, it's going to be stale, maybe moldy, cold for sure. Miraculously, the breads here remained fresh and warm for the entire week. So the Kohanim would eat it, and they would have a nice, fresh, warm piece of bread, even though it sat there for a week inside the temple. So that was a miracle, which we'll try to discuss that a little more later as well. Yes?
Could you explain again how it's matzah and it's thick and fluffy?
How is it matzah if it was thick and fluffy is his question.
What?
How is it matzah if it's thick and fluffy? That's his question. So technically, any type of dough that does not sit for 18 minutes is not chametz, it's matzah. We call that matzah. The reason our matzahs are thin and hard and cracker-like is because we're so nervous on Pesach that maybe, you know, there's something in there that didn't get baked fully or didn't get water on it, or we're so concerned and we're so careful at Pesach, we're very, very strict in how we make our matzah. We make it thin, we burn it to a crisp, we do it really, really fast, we punch holes in it. That's all because we're so nervous about chametz. But technically, if it wasn't for us being nervous about chametz and being so stringent, you can have a thick piece of bread that is baked very, very fast, and it wouldn't be considered chametz, it'd be considered matzah. Even to this very day, certain Yemenite Jews, and even some Sephardi Jews, use like pita-like matzahs. The Ashkenazi matzah is the thick cracker stuff. But you can see, especially in Israel, you can see that a lot of the Sephardi, and especially I think the Yemenite Jews in Israel, they actually have like a pita-like, you know, fluffy matzah. Much more appetizing to many of us than our cracker-like matzahs. So because they never took on the stringency the Ashkenazi Jews took on. So, but we're so stringent on Pesach to avoid any possibility that maybe it'll become chametz, we flatten it out, we bake it really, 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 you know, in a very hot oven to make sure that there's no chance anything in there became chametz. So, in the Beis HaMikdash, almost all of the breads were actually matzah, they weren't chametz. There's only two sacrifices that involved bread that were chametz. There was the Thanksgiving offering involved, the Karmat Torah involved some chametz, and the two loaves of bread offered on Shavuos involved chametz. But every other bread or flour offering in the Beis HaMikdash was actually not chametz, it was matzah. So these were also not chametz. These were, we call matzah, even if they looked like bread, they were actually not chametz. They were never leavened, they were matzah. So they were 12 of them. They were made, as you can see here, in a very unique shape. This picture, the shape of this picture is according to one opinion. There's many opinions about what the shape actually was, but it was not a normal loaf of bread. It wasn't like a challah. It was some sort of box type shape. And it was, you can see in the picture, at least one possibility of what that shape looked like. It was the Mishnah states that it was a very special skill that one family of Kohanim knew to make bread like that. Because most of us, we tried to, it would collapse into itself. And they knew the technique of how to make a bread in that shape. They were actually blamed for not teaching others the technique. They kind of held it for themselves, so they wanted to have that honor and that merit. But the Mishnah says that we don't remember them favorably because of that family. But there was a special skill to bake the bread in that shape.
Actually, there's another lesson. Hashem provides somebody with a parnasa and nobody can take it away from them.
But it wasn't a parnasa. It was a family of Kohanim that had a job at the Semikdash. That wasn't how they got paid. You know, they didn't get paid for it.
No, it's okay. That's okay. There's survival skills. If there is something in the Mishnah or somewhere where the rabbis tried to reproduce it and do what they did. They couldn't duplicate it.
Right.
The lesson that I have read is that Hashem arranges to give certain people certain skills and
right.
they own it. So there's a positive view of that.
Right. I understand the lesson, but I mean, they didn't make any money off of what they did. So I don't know, in terms of livelihood, I don't know if we can apply it to that. Along with these breads, they put 2 spoons of, you can see here, lavona, of frankincense, type of incense, which was offered up every Shabbos. It was burnt on the altar as they took the breads. They take the breads away, they take the 2 spoonfuls of incense, and they would burn it on the altar prior to eating the breads. So that came along with the sacrifice. The bread itself was not offered as sacrifice, it was eaten by the Kohanim. So the bread was never burnt on the altar, the bread was eaten by the Kohanim every Shabbos. And again, it was miraculously warm and fresh, as if it just came out of the oven the week before. That's what the Gemara tells us.
In that sense, it's like man. Well,
in that sense, yeah, because it wouldn't. Well, man, I mean, the day you had it, it was fresh and wouldn't spoil. The next day, it would spoil the man. The man would spoil the next day, yeah.
Can it actually sit on the shulchan, the showbread, to actually sit as a base on the shulchan?
You know, so the bottom one would, and then they actually had little like shelves. To hold each, they didn't want to place them on top of the other for 2 reasons. Number one, they might crush one another, and number two, you want to have airflow so they will not be moldy. Because even though miraculously they stayed fresh, we have to do our part of keeping things fresh. We don't rely upon miracles. So if they all sat one on top of the other, they wouldn't have airflow. You're sitting in the hot Middle Eastern, you know, summer, they'll get moldy. So you want to have as much airflow as possible. So they would stack them up. They had these little little beams, poles coming out from the structure. And they placed the bread upon these poles. That's how it worked. But the bottom ones were actually right upon the table itself. That's how the structure worked. Once a week. Every they would bake it on Friday and they'd put it on Shabbos. Yeah.
Yep, so they didn't have to stay from one Shabbos to the other, even though they didn't eat them. They have fresh the next Shabbos. That's what I was trying to figure out. They did have fresh the next Shabbos.
Well, they would replace them each Shabbos.
Right.
And then they'd eat the week old ones that they would do. Yeah. So the week old one would still be fresh, you know. You go to the bakery, you have a sticker and a day-old cake, and it used to be a week-old cake, and it'd still be delicious. So that's the miracle of it. So that's, in short, the shulchan, the details of the shulchan, and the lechem apanim, the showbreads. So what's some of the messages and lessons we can take out of this vessel of the temple in this service, which was done with the showbreads? So let's start with the commentary of Rabbeinu Bachaya. We understand in general that the Beis HaMikdash, the Mishkan, was the place where God's blessing emanates to the world. So the blessings of God, they all kind of, you know, stem forth from the Mishkan and outwards. That's how we view it. God's blessings all emanate from this temple. The Shulchan is the place through which God sends material blessing to the Jewish people. The breads, that's the staple of our livelihood, staple of our lives is bread. Now that's how we view the main food of a human being is bread. And through this bread, which was a service in the temple, God would send his blessings to the Jewish people. From here, this is where God was going to bless us with livelihood, bless us with being satiated, bless us with food. And even the breads itself, the Gemara tells us the Kohanim would eat the bread, they eat a tiny piece of the bread and they feel full. Because, you know, it's not the quantity of food, but it's how much the food nourishes us. So this food would nourish us in the sense you could take one little piece and feel full from it. And, you know, God's blessing in food is not just how much food you eat, but how nourishing and healthy the food is for your body. So this bread is something which miraculously would satiate a Kohen even with just a little bit. The Kli Yakar states that the dimensions, we said were 2 by 1 by 1.5. That was the dimensions of the Shulchan. So if you remember from a few weeks ago, we discussed the dimensions of the Aron, of the Holy Ark. And the dimensions of the Holy Ark were all half dimensions. It was 2.5 by 1.5 by 1.5. This is 2 by 1 by 1.5. So again, there's no coincidences in God's temple. Everything is exact. Everything is to the T. So why is it that we have whole measurements on the Shulchan, and we have all half measurements when it comes to the Aron? So the Kli Yakar states that the Aron represents material wealth, material blessing. In the world of material wealth, there's limits. Worldly matters have limits. You know, this world is a limited world. You can only eat so much. You know, you can only go so far. You know, a person gets a certain amount of money, there's only so much you can do with it. I mean, everything is limited within our physical world. In the spiritual world, things are limitless. The Holy Ark represents the spiritual world. It represents the Torah. It represents where God's the spirituality of God comes to the world. So that's something which was half measurement, showing that it's you're incomplete. know, there's no limits to it. Half means that there's still more to go. There's always more to go when it comes to low spirituality. The shulchan, which is material wealth, so there's limitations. There's a completion to it. They're two by one. They're round numbers, meaning that, you know, we've hit our limit. When it comes to spiritual, when it comes to material wealth, when it comes to physical well-being, there are limitations. There's a certain extent in which we'll feel comfortable, and a certain extent beyond that which limits us. Both positively and negatively. You know, someone eats the right amount, you feel great. You enjoy it, you feel great. Too much, you feel terrible. Nobody's ever felt terrible for doing too many mitzvahs. I don't think anyone's going to complain. I feel awful. I did too many mitzvahs. That's not, because when it comes to spirituality, there's no limits. You can always do more and more good. There's no limits to that. Also, he writes that the idea of feeling content with material possessions is a very important concept for a Jew. We should never feel that we shouldn't be jealous. We shouldn't always want more. We should feel I'm very happy with my lot. You know, who is truly wealthy? It says in Pirkei Avos, someone is happy with his lot. So I'm complete. You know, the full measurements of the Shulchan say that we should feel complete in the world of physical wealth. I feel I have what I need. In the world of spirituality, of the Aron, of the Holy Ark, we should always feel that I can do more and more. I'm incomplete. I need to do more. I need to learn more Torah, do more mitzvahs. I need to reach out more to God, to other people. We should always feel incomplete in that world. So the Aron had half measurements, showing that there's a type of incompletion felt when it comes to the Aron. But when it comes to the Shulchan, we should feel complete. We should feel that we have what we need. I'm content because the material goods, I feel content. I have what I need. This is the contrast you find between Esav and Yaakov. Yaakov is quoted to say, Yeshli Kol, I have everything. Esav says, Yeshli Rav, I have a lot. So the rabbis point out, when you say I have a lot, it means I could have more too. You know, a lot is relative. If I say I have everything, that means I don't need anything else. I have all that I need. So it could be Yaakov had less money, more money. That's not the point. The point is that Yaakov's attitude was, whatever I have is exactly what I need, and I feel content. Esav said, I got a lot, but I can always have more. That's the reaction. So when it comes to spirituality, we should all say, I have a lot, but I want more. When it comes to Torah knowledge, when it comes to mitzvahs, I have a lot, but I want more. When it comes to material wealth, we should say, I have what I need. I feel content, I feel satiated, I'm not always looking for more and more. That's not where I'm putting my main strength. My main strength is put into the world of spirituality, into doing good, performing mitzvahs, reaching out to others, reaching out to God. And for that, there's no limit. The height of the Shulchan, though, was a half measurement. Right, the width and the length were 2 by 1, was complete measurements, but the height was 1.5, it was a half measurement. So what's the concept of the height being a half measurement? If we're supposed to be content in the world of physical and material wealth and gains, then why is there a half measurement, which seems to signify lacking something? So Kuyakar writes, it's a half measure. The height is a half measurement because it means we shouldn't feel arrogance. I shouldn't be standing up fully straight, you know, feeling proud of myself when it comes to my wealth. I should feel content, but not feel arrogant. So the height, the length, and the width are all full measurements, round numbers, meaning that I feel content. The height is a half, saying you have to exercise humility. So when it comes to how tall you stand, meaning your personal ego, your arrogance, so that should be incomplete. Now you shouldn't feel arrogant from your wealth, but yeah, you should feel content by your wealth. So that's why the height is a half measurement, but the length and width are full measurements. Also, he writes, the idea of the height being a half measurement means that we should not go at length to fill all of our physical desires. We should feel content, but we have to have self-control. So I should stop myself at a certain point. You know, I ate well, I feel satiated, don't eat the last piece of cake. So there has to be a point where I break myself. It's a half measurement saying that once I feel content, stop right there. And don't move on. We all know what it's like. We had a good meal, we feel good. We eat too much dessert, we feel terrible. Remember what that's like. Because we didn't have self-control. We have to exercise a little willpower when it comes to physical material gains, and physical material wealth, and pleasure. We just say, I feel satiated and content by it, but I don't go all out to fulfill every desire I have. So we have a half measurement involved in the height, even though you have full measurements in the length and width. And it's not good for our body or our soul. Obviously it's not good for the body. If we overindulge, it's not good for our bodies, we all know that. It's not good for our soul, because the more and more physical we become, the less spiritual we become. The two things sometimes cannot connect. So if I'm always looking for an extra piece of cake, I'm not looking for an extra mitzvah. They seem to counteract one another. So therefore, we should feel content and satiated, but not overindulge and have self-control. So we have whole measurements, the length and the width, and a half measurement in the height. There's a very interesting explanation of the Vilna Gaon. There's a verse in, I believe it's in Proverbs, in Mishle. The verse says, Tzadik ochel sova nafsho, a righteous person eats to satiate his soul. Urashayim, the wicked, yechsar bitnam, their stomach is lacking. So the usual understanding of that is that God provides for a righteous person, and they're able to eat and be satiated. Someone who's wicked is lacking in his stomach. That's how we usually understand it. The Vilna Gaon says, I'll tell you a different interpretation. And it's a very interesting interpretation. It's kind of cute, but it's a very important lesson. He says that a righteous person eats until he's satiated, but someone who's wicked, he's lacking a stomach, meaning he wishes he had two stomachs so he could eat more. You know, we felt that before. You're at a wedding and the food is delicious, and you know you don't eat so much. And, you know, you want to eat more because it's delicious food, but like you're full, and if you eat more, you'd feel sick. But if we had a second stomach, I would put more into my mouth because it's good food. He's saying that that's the attitude of someone who is Russia. He's saying that attitude is saying that I eat to eat. That's why I eat. And if I could eat more, I would eat more. Unfortunately, God only gave one stomach, so I have to stop right here. So he's saying, no, the attitude is to be, a tzaddik eats to be satiated. I enjoy my food. It's delicious. I had a good time. I'm satiated, but I don't live to eat. I eat to live. You know, that's the famous quote. So therefore, I eat till I'm satiated, and I thank God, and I feel happy about it. But I don't wish for another stomach. Rather, I'm happy I'm satiated, and now I can go on with my life and do what has to be done. Yeah.
Is there another possible reason for more than Russia? Maybe they're feeling like lonely, or they're feeling emotionally low or something. They're not really a Russia, but they just have some kind of emotional need to eat more.
He's not saying the need to eat more. He's saying that the wish that I can keep on eating and eating and eating. That's where someone who says that. Someone who eats because, you know, people eat because they feel lonely. People eat because they're feeling down. And that's that there is a need which they're trying to fill through that. Someone who says that I'm full, but I just want to eat because I love eating, right? They're saying that's an attitude of a Russia. Obviously, someone who does, I'm not saying that person is a wicked person, but there's an attitude of a tzaddik, attitude of Russia. The ideal attitude of a tzaddik is that I eat to be satiated, but I don't live to eat. I eat to live, and therefore, once I'm full and I feel healthy, I feel good, I can go out and do what I have to do in life. The attitude of somebody who we call Russia is that I live to eat. If it's too bad that I'm full, because I wish I could just keep on eating, because that's what life's all about for me. Right. No, but that would fall into the satiating. There's a need to be satiated. I'm saying there's a difference. Eating, being satiated. I mean, obviously it's not a healthy thing to eat for emotional needs either. We know that, but that's still, you're satiating a need that you have, versus saying that I eat because I want to eat. Because that's how I get my greatest pleasure in life, is through eating. That's an attitude which we try to avoid. So that's where we have the full measurements in terms of length and width, and a half measurement in the height, to show that there is a point that I'm supposed to cut off my eating and say, I'm satiated, now let's use some willpower and stop. Because I don't live to eat. I don't eat to live, I live to eat. No, I live to... You're right. You're right. I don't live to eat, I eat to live. There you go. Could be they're both said. And that's the reason why the symbolism, at least, we talked about, there's this idea of the misgeres. There is a rim, a frame going around the shulchan. Because the idea, the misgeres, the root of the Hebrew misgeres is soger, which is to close in, closed. Because when it comes to the material wealth, when it comes to physical appetites, when it comes to physical desires, we have to keep it limited, we have to control it. So you can't just have it open. You have to have a rim around it, saying that it's appropriate until this point. But at this point, I shut it off. I say, that's too much. And I use my own willpower and self-control to shut it off. So that rim symbolizes the idea of controlling ourselves, having willpower. And that's an act of nobility. The zer, the crown, comes out from the rim. Because when it comes to nobility in the world of physical desires and material gain, where does one become noble in that area? When you limit yourself. When you're able to say, what I've done until now has been good for me, appropriate. If I keep on going, I indulge even more, that's going to be bad for me, inappropriate. And that's nobility. That's royalty. Because, I mean, as self-control, we say, who is the greatest hero? Ezu Gibor. Who's the greatest hero? The one who is Kovach Ditzro, who can control his own personal desires. Self-control, the Jewish king is someone who is in self-control. That's true nobility from the Torah's perspective. Self-control. I mentioned before that the word in Hebrew for king is melech. Melech, king, is an acronym, could be understood as an acronym for moach, lev, klaios, brain, heart, kidneys. Because I don't let my stomach dictate who I am, I let my brain dictate who I am. My brain dictates my emotions dictate what I eat. Rather than letting what I eat dictate my emotions dictate my brain. So the true mobility in Judaism is when your brain is in control. Your brain says you've eaten enough. If you eat any more, you're going to feel sick, or it's going to be after your cholesterol, or it's going to, put you to sleep. You need to stay up and do something. So at that point, that's when your brain has to tell your stomach to stop. And that's the self-control, which is considered nobility. That's a king. That's beautiful. That's royalty in Judaism. So the zer, the crown of the shulchan, it comes out from the mezgeres, from closing in that rim, which is the self-control, that generates the crown. That's what makes a person royal. Rav Shimshon Pinkus writes a different symbolism for the dimensions of the shulchan. As we discussed a few weeks ago, Rav Pinkus is the one who taught us about the aron. He says that when you have a half measurement, that denotes a relationship. There's partnership. There's a half. A half means there's another half. That's what a half always symbolizes. So when the aron was all half measurements, that's because Torah, no matter what you do with Torah, you study Torah, no matter how you study Torah, that generates a relationship with God. So whether it's the breadth of Torah, the length of Torah, the width of Torah, the height of Torah, any way one studies Torah, that helps to generate a relationship with God, because Torah is that which connects us to God. So the Aron was all half measurements. That makes a partnership, relationship. When it comes to the Shulchan, it's only a half measurement in the height, but the length and width are whole measurements. Why? Because eating doesn't inherently connect you with God. Eating can be a very physical act. It can be an animalistic act. That's how you do it. You see someone who eats like a pig, and there's nothing spiritual about it. But
did you say annihilistic?
What?
Did you say annihilistic?
Like a pig, I said. I say that.
Before that? Thing, yeah.
I did not say that.
Act is, wasn't sure what you said.
Oh, yeah. What did I say? I say eating does not inherently connect you with God in any way. It could be animalistic, I said.
Oh, animalistic,
right. Depending on how one eats, it could be something which is animalistic, it could be neutral, it could be godly. There's different ways of eating, right? It could be mitzvah. Right, there's different ways of eating. So the length and width of the shulchan are whole measurements, which mean that normal everyday eating does not inherently automatically connect you to God. It doesn't create a partnership necessarily. But the height of it is a half measurement. I mean, because if you eat with the right intent, it does connect you to God. So there's different ways of what one can eat. So if we look upwards as we eat, meaning we're directing our eating towards God, using it as a way to connect to God, that connects us. If we don't, it doesn't connect us. When it comes to the Aron, the Torah study, no matter how we do it, it connects us to God. So the Aron is all half measurements. This has a half measurement only upwards, but not when the plane of length and width. So for instance, like Phil was pointing out, there's times where eating is a mitzvah. We just had a Purim Suda 2 days ago on Sunday. That's a tremendous mitzvah. And that eating itself is a mitzvah. A joyous Purim Suda is holy eating. A Shabbos meal is holy eating. It's a mitzvah. One who eats because they want to have strength so they can go and perform mitzvahs, that's a mitzvah. One who says a blessing before they eat, recognizes God as the source of the food. So the eating now is transformed into a holy act because I'm using the food as a platform to connect with God. That's all making my eating holy and connecting me to God through eating. But if I just sit down and I just start stuffing food in my mouth, so there's nothing godly about that at all. So there's different ways one could eat. So that's why in the length and width of eating, that's all, that could be very mundane, that could be very neutral, and that could even be animalistic, as we said. But if you look up as you eat, symbolizing that you're trying to connect to God through the food, to see that the chesed, the kindness of God, that God gave us so many foods that were tasty, different textures, eaten different ways, so many of us for variety. The fact that food gives me strength, makes me healthy, helps me carry on, that's all a way we can connect to God, seeing God's kindness through the food. But again, stuffing it down our throats, that's not going to connect us with God in any way, shape, or form. Rav Pinkus also writes that how come the length and the width are different? The length is, it's 2 by 1, is the length and width, 2 by 1 of the shulchan. So he says the length of the shulchan represents quantity of food. The width represents the quality of the food. So the length is like how far you're going to go, how much you're going to do, and then the width would be like, how great is it along the way. So he says that the width is the quality, and the length is the quantity. So Rav Pinkus writes that in terms of quantity, we have to eat the right amount of food to remain healthy and alive and functioning. So we never want to skimp on the right quantity of food. We want to eat the proper amount of food for our lives. For the quality of food, we don't mean eating, you know, poison food or unhealthy food or moldy food, but in terms of being picky about our foods, he says that that can be only one amma thing. You guys, you know what? We don't have to be so picky about what we eat. We have to appreciate what we have, eat to be healthy. But sometimes we get so picky about our foods, we don't want to eat that, that's a day old, those are leftovers, I don't like this one, I'm not in the mood for this. He says, you know, that the lesson of the Torah is, you should have food that you like, but don't overdo it. Don't be so picky that you're gonna reject the food you have, not appreciate the food that we have. So the quality of the food we have, meaning, you know, how it meets my own personal taste buds, that can only be a one. But the quantity should always be a two. The quantity, you should never skip on the proper amount of food to eat. That you need to eat to be healthy and to function in your daily life. And we don't have to have perfect meals all the time. That's his point.
Width is quality and length is quantity.
Width is quality and length is quantity, yes. Yeah. And this brings us to another important point, which is, it's sourced in the Gemara, the Talmud. It says that in the times of the Beis HaMikdash, a person was atoned for through the altar. We bring sacrifices, offer them up on the Mizbeach, on the altar, and that bring atonement. The Gemara says, but nowadays, when we have no altar, our table is atoned for us. Our kitchen table atones for us. So what does that mean? That can be taken in many different ways, but the main understanding of the commentaries is that it refers to, what do we do? Is a table in our homes a place where we experience the blessings of Hashem? Is it a place where we share those blessings with others? Our table has to be a place where we share blessings with other people. Right, that's for sure. So the angle they're taking is more of sharing food with those who are needy. Right, Shabbos guests, people who need a meal, people who are poor, people who are lonely. Our table's places where we're reaching out to others, giving tzedakah through our tables. So if our table in our home is a place that we share our table with others and give to those who are in need, so that's the sacrifice. I'm sacrificing of my own personal wealth and personal food to help another person. That's equivalent to a sacrifice in the temple. That creates atonement. There was an early custom amongst French Jews, a very fascinating custom, which they used to take their kitchen tables and make their caskets out of it when they died. Very fascinating thing. It's quoted in a few different sources. This is amongst the French Jews. Why would they do this? Because they would show that what do you take with you to the next world? The way they utilize your table, that's the wealth that goes into the next world. So if you utilize your table to share with others, so that's wealth you're taking with you. If your table is used for selfish purposes, so then that also goes with you. There's nothing left over there, right? So the table symbolizes, of all the wealth we have, how much do I share it with other people? So if it's shared with others, that goes with me to the next world. And if not, then it doesn't. That's not what you take with you. What's in your bank account doesn't go with you. What you have stored up doesn't go with you. What goes to you is that the tzedakah you've given is really an investment for the world to come. Every penny of tzedakah I give, that penny is waiting for your bank account in the world to come. That's where that penny is. And that's symbolized by what we do with our tables. Again, the table is only a model of giving in general, that we give of our own personal wealth and time and energy to other people. So the table is our model for that. So in our days, the way we utilize our table is sharing this wealth and material success with others. That's how we're going to get true atonement in this world. It says that tzedakah saves from death. It's in the verse, tzedakah tatzil mimavis. Tzedakah saves from death because atonement comes through tzedakah. That's one of our main forms of atonement nowadays when there's no holy temple anymore. We can't bring sacrifices, we give tzedakah. So it is a fascinating custom. They would actually take their tables and they would make it into their caskets to bury them.
This doesn't survive today?
Not that I'm aware of. I don't think so. It's quoted as a very early French custom. That's how it's quoted. Right. So along this line of thought, the Kli Yakar writes that we discussed there's poles that go through it, and you used to carry the shulchan by these poles. The verse says, the way it describes the poles, the loops, these little loops here, these rings that hold the poles, are described as batim levadim. Those are houses for the poles. So many of the vessels had poles going through rings, but no vessel had the same description. This word is batim levadim, are only used when it comes to the shulchan, not to other vessels. So Kli Yakar writes, batim levadim. The word vadim, abad, so it could mean a pole, But Ba'ak also means somebody who is needy, somebody who is lonely. The idea of Levad in Hebrew, Levad means to be alone. Someone who's bodeed is alone. So Badim can mean somebody who's alone. So if I use my table and I make my table a home for those who are needy, that's what creates true atonement, and that's the true purpose of our wealth, to share with the people who need it. So our tables should become Batim Levadim, the homes welcoming to those who are needy. Those who need to be at our table should be at our table. That's Batim Levadim. You can even rearrange the letters that Leopgar writes, of Levadim. If you just reverse the Lamed and the Beis in the beginning of the word, it says Bedalim. Actually, you reverse the Lamed with the, I put it after the Dal, it would be Bedalim, which means to those who are poor. Batim Bedalim, those who are poor. So there is a hint in this verse that our tables, our own personal tables in our homes, are meant to help those who are needy. Batim Levadim. It's a home for those who are lonely, those who are needy, and those who need the help. And this is how you carry the table. The table is carried through these Batim Levadim, these groups, which are housing the poles, which symbolize making our tables into homes for those who are needy. That's how you carry the table. I mean, the whole purpose, the whole way the table is supported by that. That's what it symbolizes. If God gives a person wealth, material success, to share the wealth. That's why we have it. A person is privileged to be successful. It's because God has given the responsibility to help those who are in need. People, institutions, help those who are in need. And therefore, the Batim Levadim, the whole Shulchan is carried by these loops, which represent the fact that our home should be a place for those who are loners and those who are needy, and we should share wealth with those who need it. So that's the idea of Batim Levadim. I just want to quickly, before we end, I just want to discuss in short the Lechem HaPanim. So the purpose of the Shulchan ultimately was to carry the Lechem HaPanim, the showbreads, the 12 showbreads.
That's what it's called.
Lechem HaPanim. Yeah, right. Lechem HaPanim. So Lechem HaPanim were on the Shulchan. And just like we have a table in our homes where we put our bread on to eat, so there's a table, and on that table would be the Lechem HaPanim. What was the idea of this service of Lechem HaPanim? So the Sefer HaChinuch writes that, you know, bread is a staple of life. We are in need of the constant blessing of Hashem when it comes to our personal sustenance and livelihood. As you know, unfortunately, you know, as we see in the economy in recent years, that blessing has to constantly be there. No one can ever feel confident in what they have. We have to have God's constant blessing to keep things going. The rabbis even tell us that poverty is a cycle in the world which hits every family at some point, whether or not it's ourselves and our kids or our grandkids. Poverty cycles itself through the world, through families, throughout the generations. And we need God's constant blessing in livelihood. So when we actually perform a service in the Beis HaMikdash, which surrounds a certain area of life, that's what brings God's blessing into the world, that area of life. A service which pertains to bread brings God's blessing into the bread of the world, into our own sustenance and livelihood in the world. The concept exists with many other things in the Beis HaMikdash. Many of life's staples, there is a service in the Beis HaMikdash at some point in the year in order to bring blessing to that staple of life. So for instance, Sukkot is the time where we say we're judged for water for the year, and there was an offering of water on Sukkot. There is an offering of barley during the time of the barley harvest. There's an offering of wheat, time of the wheat harvest. I mean, in the Beis HaMikdash, they would perform a service with the actual food item, which is relevant that time of year. But bread is relevant every day of our lives. We have to eat, and we have to be healthy every day of our lives. So there was a constant service of the bread being on this table every single day, always, in the Beis HaMikdash. And it even says tamid. It should be there always, non-stop, to the extent that when they would replace it, there would be four sets of kohanim. There are two stacks. So one set of kohanim would grab, you know, one of the stacks, and the new set would slide it in, you know, seamlessly slide in the new stack. Yeah, so it was constantly on the table. Because we had that constant blessing of God when it comes to bread. So that's one opinion of how they would do it. But it would be a seamless transition, so the table was never bare from the Lechem HaPanim. Always had Lechem HaPanim on that table. There was a miracle, as we said. The miracle was it stayed fresh and warm all week long. And this is an expression of God's love for Jewish people. God said, you know, I picture it like, look at a nice Jewish bubby. You know, their kids come to visit, nice warm food ready, you know, to provide. You know, that's how God is providing. God says, you know, you have this food, you have to eat it. I don't want to make you eat stale bread. I'm going to keep it warm and fresh for you so you can enjoy the food when it's time to eat it. That's what God tells us. It's an expression of love for Jewish people. The idea of Lechem HaPanim. So literally the word panim means a face. It was the bread of face. The one concept of Lechem HaPanim.
Does the cosmos make the minion next door? That's very cool. So is that a year it's in there?
Next door, the A royal dragon.
Yeah.
Okay. Finds it there. Okay, good. The idea of panim, so we said that it has this funny shape. It's like a box-type shape, so it would have like a flat face. That's the simple understanding of panim. There's a flat face to the bread. So it's been in a box-like shape. A panim as a face also denotes that there is a face-to-face relationship between God and your people. It was intimacy.
This is more flat.
Right. I guess when we talk about like the face of an item, usually looking at like a flat area, like of an item, Yeah, you know, if you have like a,
I don't know,
even three-dimensional, like a box, the face of the box, I guess. I don't know. Point well taken. Yeah, point well taken. But also the idea of face means that when we look at one another, it means we have a relationship. I look someone in the eye, we have a relationship with that person. You know, if you give to somebody something, but you say, okay, take it, I'm out of here. So they're saying, okay, I'm happy to give you what you need, but I don't want to make a relationship with you. You know, sometimes, you know, there's somebody, let's say somebody keeps bothering you for something. You know, the person gets on your nerves. You feel like you should give it to them because, you know, whatever, you feel bad. So you say, okay, take it. You know, you look at them, you walk away. So that's not a face-to-face relationship. Sometimes somebody, you know, you appreciate the person, you have a relationship. So you look in the eye, you say, here you go, I'm happy to give it to you. So God, the idea of Lechem Apanim, it was showed the relationship of God to us, that God has this face-to-face relationship with Jewish people. There's an intimacy. And I'm providing you with your bread, with your meals, with your warm, fresh meals on a day-to-day basis. And the Gemara says that when the Jews would come up for the regil, when they would make the pilgrimage for the holidays, so they would actually open the doors of the temple, and they would display to the entire people the bread. And they would say, Re'u chibasa lefnei hamakom, look how dear you are to God, that this bread is still warm and fresh a week after it was placed there. And they would show the entire people this bread to display God's love for the Jewish people. That's what they would do. And this is an image. The 12 breads represent the 12 tribes. And God is saying, I have a love for all 12 tribes. And like you said, like a parent to a child, like a nice bubby making warm meals for her grandchildren, that's the way to view it. And we show the entire people, that I have a love for all 12 tribes of Israel. I kept everybody's bread warm, fresh for them, you know, so that they can feel my love. And that was the idea of the Lechem Apanim, was to display that love to the Jewish people. That they would open it up and display it to the entire nation at the holidays to show that God loves you. And even when we do things which are wrong, you know, that love is still there. So we'll stop for this week with the Lechem Apanim. Any questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.